Okay, well, thanks everybody for coming here today. It's quite a good crowd, and I know the weather's a little bit inclement, so even more kudos for you to come. Now, there's been quite a lot of talk over the last few months about the standoff between the United States and Iran, and probably from an Australian perspective, even more now that the US has come asking for a potential contribution to a maritime coalition in the Gulf, to which Australia is yet to respond, but I think we can guarantee that there'll be some kind of response in the positive at some point in the future. And to discuss both how the US views the situation and equally as importantly, how the Iranians may view the situation, we're joined here today by three experts in a panel discussion. First of all, we have Gorana Gurgic, who's a lecturer in the Department of Government and International Relations at the University of Sydney and also a lecturer at the US Studies Centre. She researches US foreign policy and transatlantic relations and conflict resolution. Next to Gorana is Dr. Amir Mogadem, who's a conjoint academic at the University of Newcastle and has his PhD from the University of Newcastle, and also has a lower degree from the Art University of Tehran. And next to him is Dr. Mahmoud Pagu, who has a PhD in social and political thought from the Australian Catholic University, and his research really looks at society and politics in post-revolutionary Iran, and he has lower degrees from the Tabiat Mudaris University and the Imam Sadr University from Tehran. And we'll be looking at US approaches to the region and also Iranian responses and Iranian views of the region. But just to give people a little bit of a potted history of where we have come to today, on the 14th of July in 2015, what's known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Nuclear Agreement, was signed between Iran and the permanent five members of the United Nations, the EU and Germany. And on the 8th of May 2018, the United States, under President Trump, unilaterally withdrew from the agreement, and sanctions were reimposed on Iran from November 2018. Iran, in response, has taken a number of steps, including resuming enrichment of uranium above the 3.6%, and also has halted the sales of its excess enriched uranium and heavy water. Now, more concerningly, in the Gulf, on the 14th of May 2019, four empty tanker ships were attacked. On the 14th of June, two tankers were attacked above the waterline. On the 20th of June, a drone was shot down, a US drone was shot down. On the 4th of July this year, an Iranian tanker, the Grace 1, was seized by the UK authorities in Gibraltar. And a few hours ago, it was released. And in response, on the 19th of July, a UK tanker and crew was seized by the Iranians. We have the US wanting to put together a maritime coalition, of which Australia has been asked to be part of, and we've already seen Germany decline. We don't know what stage we're at with that. And as I said, the Iranian tanker was released earlier today despite a US seizure warrant being placed on it, but the Gibraltar authorities said that they had committed no crime in the European Union, and so it was let to sail off to the east as far as we're aware. So that's where we are today. And so I think in order to put a lot of that into more perspective, I'd just like first to ask Gorana just to give us a rundown in very broad terms about what, if anything, constitutes a Trump foreign policy, both more broadly, but also more specifically with respect to Iran. How does the Trump administration view the world and view Iran as part of it?
Yeah, So if I was, thank you first of all for having me over here. It's a great honor and a privilege to join the panel. So just to preempt this, I'm a transatlanticist and a student and a scholar of U.S. foreign policy. I'm not a Middle East expert, and that's why I'm particularly looking forward to my co-panelist's contribution. Now, in terms of Trump's approach to foreign policy and whether there is such a thing as foreign policy doctrine, if you wish, on part of the Trump administration, we could be very kind of crude and say, well, basically, it's to undo everything that the Obama administration did over the 8 years it was in power. So any sort of deal that was made or kind of policy decision, we've seen all of that more or less kind of going down the drain from the very first moment President Trump entered in the office. But all jokes aside, I mean, there are certain tendencies, and you would have noticed them, and certainly President Trump is the one that sees the world very much in kind of zero-sum terms, right? That basically it's the kind of world where each man is left to his or her own devices, right? And that there is no such thing as the kind of international cooperation or benefits of any sort of multilateral deals, because ultimately, there is no greater good. It's if one profits, someone else has to kind of bear the cost or pay the cost. So in those sense, in those kind of terms, President Trump has always expressed that he's much more kind of unilateralist and prone to make deals which represent the interests of the United States rather than the kind of collective good of the international community, so to speak. In terms of where the administration has been at with respect to the Middle East, I think that there has been a clear kind of turn from what we've seen under the Obama administration, which has essentially tried playing this kind of balancing act of satisfying, in a sense, both the Gulf partners, particularly Saudi Arabia and kind of the traditional ally, Israel, and trying to engage in some sort of diplomatic rapprochement with Iran. This is something that the broader Republican Party leadership has seen actually as detrimental to U.S. interests. And if we just go back to 2015, kind of coming to summer of 2015 when JCPOA was signed, there was a huge domestic opposition to the Iran deal on part of the Republican Party. So the GOP, especially in the Senate, was really kind of calling out President Obama and saying that essentially he's betraying the country by entering into this agreement. And there was even this sort of funny moment, I mean, funny from one perspective, where Tom Cotton, one of the senators in the U.S. Congress, he's a Republican, he penned a letter and found a number of co-signatories from the Republican Party and addressed it to the Iranian leadership and saying that if you had read our constitution, you would know that with the stroke of the pen, President Obama can certainly enter this executive agreement, but whoever comes next in the office, if that's a Republican president, that person can well undo that agreement. And that's exactly what President Trump did in May of last year. So this was an unprecedented, actually, moment, if you think about the kind of the idea that politics should stop at the water's edge, for, you know, U.S. to have such a dissonant kind of message where the executive branch is basically advocating for this deal that would essentially deal with a major international issue, one of nuclear proliferation, and to have the Republican leadership go and undermine President as he goes about negotiating this deal. So in that sense, President Trump has basically fallen into the GOP line, which has been, Iran deal is no good. We basically betrayed Saudis, Israelis. We've conceded too much. Iran has been benefiting of this deal too much. It has been funneling, the resources that it has received as a result of the relaxation of sanctions into supporting some of the groups around the region that are working directly against U.S. interests, and basically this is why this deal needs to end.
Thanks for that. I suppose the follow-on question to that is, in the U.S. or the Trump administration approach to Iran, Does that fit into a specific and well thought out policy approach to Iran, or is it just another of a series of decisions that Trump makes unilaterally but sequentially? And is it or is it not part of a broader way of viewing US foreign policy?
Sure. I mean, again, there is this, there is a certainly a kind of tendency towards ripping multilateral deals and trying to renegotiate the existing deals successfully or less successfully. You know, I'll let you decide, but the record hasn't been very clear on that. But in terms of the kind of very approach to the region, that one has been very clear, and that's essentially that the rapprochement with Iran has been the wrong way to go, that it at least the way that the administration sees it. And here we have to be mindful that when we talk about it, we shouldn't just assume kind of monolithic kind of behavior on part of the U.S. administration. We do see certain members of the foreign policy bureaucracy, certain principals like the National Security Advisor John Bolton or the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who are much more hawkish and who were actually against this deal. I mean, famously Bolton said, to prevent Iran from getting the bomb, you have to bomb Iran, right? So in that sense, they are very much towing this sort of line of being much more assertive towards Iran and basically mistrustful of any sort of deal making with the Islamic Republic.
Now, I suppose one of the aspects that we don't often hear about is, you know, an Iranian perspective of how US foreign policy is impacting on them. And I suppose I'd like to throw over to our two other guests, and perhaps Mahmoud first. Could you give us a sense of how you believe the Iranian government, and when I talk about the Iranian government, the Supreme Leader on one hand and the President and the Cabinet on the other hand, view American policy towards, or Trump's policy towards Iran, and how different or similar to the popular perceptions in Iran are those views? So is Iranian government views out of step with popular Iranian opinion towards President Trump's current policy, or is it, or are they together?
Okay, yeah, there are different views in both in the government, different parts of government. I mean, Supreme Leader and hardliners who have some part of the power, and the executive branch, which is Rouhani, Zarif, and other moderates or reformists, and specifically about people and public. Also, there are different views. So to have a look, you know, what happened is that in Iran, hardliners always have been on defensive, and they were accused and were pressured by the public that you are halting the normalization of relations with the U.S. So when Rouhani came, they have started negotiations with the U.S. After, of course, the negotiations were there, but after 12 years, they reached an agreement. So... and now Trump comes. So it was a big victory for moderates and reformists. When Trump came, he has pulled, out of the agreement. And then now the moderates and reformists are under pressure, on defensive. So you have almost every day hardliners are blaming Rouhani and Zarif for this deal. Say, we told you from the beginning that it was a mistake to go negotiate with the U.S. So they're trying to just say that this was a mistake and we have to go to the to this kind of resistance options, hard military, or again restarting the nuclear, you know, capabilities and those things. So I think basically it has weakened the moderates position, reformist positions in Iran, and is strengthening hardliners, as probably in the next few minutes I'll explain how they are now starting seizing power in parliamentary elections, in presidential elections, and so on.
Ali, would you like to add anything to that, or do you think that's the way that things are?
I think that's almost what it is now, but one key point that needs to be considered is that there has been efforts in making things normal, if not right, with the US at several stages since 1979. Good examples of that would be that Iran sort of like taking side with US-supported operations in Afghanistan against Taliban or in Iraq, at least at the earlier stages of US-supported operations over there. But every time there has been a disappointment coming from the US side, like particularly with regards to Iranians sort of siding with America in case of Iraq, right after that, Iran was ranked as axis of evil. So every little action that was a move through making things normal with USA was sort of responded disappointingly from the US part. And then the extreme point of that was the nuclear deal. Like, it was very, very, very hard sell for Iranian reformists as well. It had its own opposition in Iran. Everybody from the hardliners were saying that it's a bad deal. You sold our country, that sort of thing. But the argument was that deal is a deal and we can make things normal. Now, as my friend said, the hardliners appear to be on the right side, and yeah, it makes things very complicated.
One of the other issues when you deal with, for a country like Iran dealing with a democracy like the United States, you know, there are changes of administration, so relations with the Obama administration were obviously better than they currently are with the Trump administration. And given the permanency of Iranian political institutions like the Office of the Supreme Leader, do you think there are different temporal views of how Iran looks at the United States? So do they have a short-term way of approaching the US administration and a medium-term way of viewing the administration? So a short-term view might be how do we have to look at the Trump administration until the presidential elections next year, and then let's reevaluate after that? Or do you think relations are so toxic at the moment that there's no real view of looking beyond those elections because the view is that the US is not going to change regardless of who's in power? So perhaps you first.
I think at least, like any other government, at the moment, let's forget about what is the title of Iran. Let's consider it as a sovereign country that wants to deal with another country that they are not in a good relationship. Of course, there are stages of planning for them. I mean, Iran showed that at hard times, act sort of like pragmatically. They wouldn't want to engage in any sort of destructive war or anything like that. But and at some point, like in last year or so, when this thing started from US getting out of the nuclear deal, there were talks about that. Yeah, we wait for this administration to go, and we resist or survive somehow, and then we go to negotiation with the next administration. But something strikingly lately I have observed was that the foreign minister in one of his latest interviews said that how we can now, if any agreement can go can be disregarded by the next administration, how we can negotiate with such an administration? How do we deal with America? Do we deal, go for negotiation for the next 6 months, for the next 6 years, or what happens next? So I think it was a sort of like not a positive move through making things normal between Iran and US by getting out of the deal. Yeah.
My What do you think there is a difference between short-term and medium-term strategic motives for Iran?
Let me give some kind of context for Iranian, you know, reaction to the West in general and what's happening, what they think about the U.S. in long term. You know, Iranians, even Foreign Minister Zarif and some moderates, they think that there is a, you know, we are now in a kind of ongoing shift of power from the U.S. toward Asia. So they see this big picture. And they think that if we be clever and we pass this kind of transitory period for, I don't know, probably 20 years, 10 years, 20 years, something, we will reach to a position that it wouldn't be possible for the U.S. to act like, you know, to act unilaterally for regime change or hard military thing or attacking Iran. So it's kind of a long-term, you know, view of many Iranians in administration that we need to be very careful. Now the world is changing. Everything is going toward Asia. China is, you know, rising. The Russia has been more assertive in its, you know, global, say, power challenges and those things. So this is long-term. But let's now go to what happened in the JCPOA when Donald Trump has pulled out. First, they started with trying to remain negotiation, remain in the deal with bringing Europeans in with that INSTEX or a special purpose vehicle. It didn't work. So there were again other, you know, negotiations, attempts to bring Russians, Chinese into deal, but it didn't help. So their conception is that the U.S. wants a very easy, no-cost regime change with the imposition of sanctions. So what we should do, we just deny them an easy victory. If there is going to be regime change, you pay the cost, you pay the expenses, not just us. So the U.S., they tried to escalate by attacking the tankers, by shutting down U.S. Drone, and especially probably more important and more inducive to conclusion by attacking Saudi Arabian and Emirati targets, which we really, proved to be somehow successful because you see lots of voices, in Emirates that they want really to de-escalate. They are somehow silently are pulling out of Yemen, at least in many parts which they have some kind of confrontation with Houthi-backed. And they have eased lots of sanctions lots of restrictions for Iranian businesses in Dubai within the last 1 month. There are some rumors that Iranians have started selling oil through Dubai with their consent, which, again, it might be somehow a kind of covert U.S. consent that's because Trump doesn't want to lose his face. He's giving concessions through other players. So this is the medium term. Basically, I think now they think, or their analysis is that Trump is going to survive and probably he will be reelected. So what they do is they're trying to again escalate. If apparently they have reached to some kind of conclusion, to some kind of agreement or understanding, probably it will continue. They will be able to survive to probably guarantee between 800 to 1 million barrels of export. If they can reach to such a thing in whatever shape it is, it doesn't need to be kind of negotiation because nor Iranians, neither Americans, Trump, they don't want to engage into. Yeah, Trump wants, you know, kind of photo op, but Iranians, they don't want to do that. So they prefer to have, you know, to reach to their goal of survival, 700, 800, something, without giving up, you know, their face, without engaging in overt, you know, open public negotiations with the U.S. And I guess they already are engaged with or reaching to some kind of conclusion. As I said, one is Dubai, You heard lots of, you know, news from coming out from Dubai about there, you know, meeting with Iranians, military, say, guard coast commanders, lots of different, you know, and of course, kind of, you know, very delicate messages, signals Houthis are sending to Emiratis by targeting very close Saudi Arabian, you know, oil facilities and military or airports near the UAE, but not targeting Emiratis. That, okay, there is a differentiation. And if you are going, you know, to, if you are not going to cooperate, it may happen in Dubai airport, it may happen in Abu Dhabi airport. This can be a disaster for you. And of course, on the other hand, there are again some news that Chinese are continuing to buy Iranian oil with apparently again some reinterpretation or different interpretation of U.S. sanctions laws, which again, by the consent of the U.S. I mean, so this might be the future, the future course. Nobody loses a face. This is a win-win for Iranian hardliners because they are already, you know, proved that we were right. This is a win for the Trump. And Iranians are not going to negotiate, but at the, I mean, they are surviving, so they can sell like a few hundred barrels of oil. Yeah, I guess.
You touched on there an issue about the way the Europeans try to come up with a special purpose vehicle, another way of allowing two-way trade with Iran by bypassing US currency actions. And also we saw recently how Germany has publicly refused to be part of the maritime multinational task force. So I suppose it's an opportunity to ask Gaurana here, if this, what, if any, cost has the Trump approach to Iran, what cost has it exacted on its relations with Europe? And the other part of that question is, do you think the Trump administration cares what that cost is?
Yeah, or to reformulate the question even further, what additional costs has it posed on the transatlantic relations, which have already been at their kind of absolute nadir pretty much ever since Trump came into the office, which is interesting as well in itself, as I say that the kind of mismatch between the administration's rhetoric and then the commitment to some parts of Europe are actually quite stark, and we have to bear that in mind as well, because even if President Trump bashes European Union or some of the member states and allies within NATO, at the same time, US has never been as engaged and committing as many resources actually to parts of Europe, particularly with some of the troop redeployments and additional deployments to the kind of eastern flank to kind of counter Russia's influence over there. So that's also something to keep in mind. But going back to your question on what this has meant for just the relations between US and Europe more broadly, certainly what we've seen is a strong commitment on part of the E3, the European three members, co-signatories of JCPOA, being Germany, Britain and France, really to the deal, even though everyone is pretty much saying now the deal is dead, there is no deal. They met last month actually in Vienna together with the Iranian representatives as well as Chinese and Russian, and they all said that they are still working and committed to keeping the deal alive, and that there wouldn't be any sanctions at the moment still for Iran actually going against the some of the provisions regarding the enrichment of uranium. And it's been really interesting to see just, I mean, again, even though they're committed, there are shades of the kind of commitment to the deal and the extent to which they are willing to support the United States actually now, because the overall consensus is that this is a mess that the Trump administration created and they better deal with it. And so you have on one end of the spectrum Germany that has said, you know, its leadership has been very clear in saying that they won't be committing any troops or any sort of boats to help the international maritime coalition. Then there's France, which kind of has always been somewhere in the middle, because French leadership wasn't too happy with the deal when it was initially signed, and they still are seeing, obviously, that the deal has not been comprehensive in the sense that it covered absolutely everything Iran does. And that was the whole, at least the argument that the Trump administration presented, right? It's about the non-nuclear aspects of the deal, which were always so troublesome and worrisome and needing U.S. To pull out. So France is kind of somewhere in the middle, and France has actually been the most active in trying to actually engage Iran and to kind of get it back into the line. And it has sent a couple of different representatives in recent months, actually, to Tehran. And then finally, you have Britain, which is supposedly U.S.'s, you know, longest, oldest friend and a special ally, right? And it has been left out in the cold a bit when Mike Pompeo famously said that they should better take care of their ships better if they don't want them to see them seized by Iran. And you know, that's not a great message you want to send if you want to enlist that country's support. So John Bolton has just recently been in the UK and has tried to basically convince Boris Johnson that UK needs to step up, it needs to join this coalition. And indeed, Westminster has now approved UK basically taking part in the international coalition. But it was very interesting how that communique, when it was published, it made no mention of the US-led Operation Sentinel, right? It just said that it will be joining some amorphous international coalition that has, you know, seemingly nothing to do with the United States. So, in short, they aren't pleased with what the United States have been doing. Having said that, some of these countries have greater interest in actually patrolling the Straits of Hormuz, because, for instance, for France and UK, it is a matter actually of exports or imports that they are getting from that part of the world. For Germany, it isn't so much about hydrocarbon imports, because it gets most of that from Russia and from Norway. So, you know, the kind of economic calculus is a bit different for some of those countries. But in all, I mean, obviously, you referred to INSTEX, that I don't know if you heard about that acronym. So that's that special facility, the Instrument in Support of Trading Exchange, very catchy name, that has basically been brought about in January of this year, but has never really lived up to what it was supposed to be, and many say that it's actually it has been dead on arrival, which is basically this sort of system to go kind of about U.S. sanctions, and originally was meant or only for food and medicine, and basically with the view for Iran to use it as well for oil exports. But it's nowhere near. I mean, it's very hard to execute that, and what's more is that actually Europeans are worried about that. European companies in particular are worried about secondary sanctions that the U.S. might impose, and have actually refrained from doing any sort of exchanges via INSTEX. So currently there are only tens of millions of euros, not even 100 million euros, that are sitting in this kind of virtual ledger that would enable these countries to trade without actually kind of barter, rather than using U.S. dollars, right, to make sure that they don't fall under U.S. sanctions. So in that sense, Europeans aren't really able to deliver some of these promises that it's going to be business as usual, even when U.S. reimposes these sanctions. So kind of a developing story, but overall it seems that U.S. will be kind of pressed to find support, at least explicit support, from its allies across the Atlantic on this one.
Thanks for the gathering. You also touched on earlier on about the one of the aims of the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure. It was trying to modify Iranian behaviour in the region and Iranian support for allied and proxy groups in the region. I suppose the last question before we go on to questions from the floor was, in the previous sanctions regime, which was, you would argue, even tighter than the current sanctions regime, there were always funds for Iran to assist its proxy and allied forces in the region, because that's the way that Iran gained strategic reach in the region. Do you sense that there is any likelihood of the current campaign of maximum pressure from the US of achieving any of those unstated aims, or sorry, they are actually stated aims, about changing Iranian support for groups like Hezbollah or the Houthi movement or any of the PMUs in Iraq? Or do you think it's going to be business as usual because Iran doesn't really have any other choice if it wants to be able to influence events in the region?
I basically think that we need to distinguish between the form of these groups with the military systems that you can see in the Western countries. Running that sort of proxy wars are expensive, but not as expensive as having US troops or British troops or even Aussie troops in any foreign land. So with a little amount of money, you can recruit dedicated religiously or nationally people who have AK-47 and fight in favor of the cause. So yes, it may affect, from my perspective, it may affect a little bit, but not as much, because first of all, it's not as expensive business as the US might think. Second, most of these groups, like Iran, has learned its lessons through other phases of being under the sanction and all those sort of things, to multiply its proxy groups' fundings and resources. So they may try something else. We don't know what are they. But from my perspective, like an institution, it's like entity, an institution like Hezbollah that has members in the government, members in the cities, and all those structure, governmental structure, they may have other sources of income. Of course, I mean, we don't know about it because it's a secret thing, but I basically think that they are running sustainably by themselves. So even in case of Houthis, the influence of Iran, yes, they send military support, and the government says no, but the Saudis say they are sending. But I think mostly is the support is more of the moral level. Yes, there are weapons engaged, but it's more like we support you, so you have a cause and that sort of thing. I don't think that the U.S. mission in that case would be as successful as they think. That's right, yeah.
I agree with Amir that Iran's, militias are very low cost, groups normally, probably except for Iran's Syrian operation, which is recently, within the last 2 years, has been really diminished. It's not too many Iranians now engaged there. In Iraq, Iraqi militias has been a source of revenue for Iran. Iran has never paid them. Iran doesn't pay them. Iran doesn't pay for their weapons. Even during the ISIS, the war with ISIS, there are lots of, as far as I know, weapons purchased from Iran through militias. Almost everything is paid by Iraqi government. So there is nothing there, affected by the sanctions. In Lebanon, it's a bit, murky. Yes, there are lots of finances going on there. But again, Hezbollah is very, very powerful, has different, arms, muscles everywhere in the world, through South America, in West Africa, in different, places. They have in Mexico lots of, businesses involved. People talk about smuggling, so whatever. So there are lots of revenue, coming. But it's for sure has been affected. For Hamas, the relations has been again very, somehow severe during last years. It's almost going on. Sometimes there are negotiations, they're trying to, because of the problem with Syria. But again, okay, in Houthis, Houthis are, again, it's very, very low cost, I mean, support. Though Iranian military, I mean, equipment are there, but it's not like, say, you know, a drone in Iran costs 10,000. It's not like, you know, $150 million or, I don't know, $10 million or 20. It's very cheap. So, but it can effectively, I mean, target many many facilities in, you know, adversary, say, nations. So the effect of sanctions on, I think, these militias hasn't been critical. Of course, there has been, you know, in Lebanon, in Syria partly, but not effective. But again, it has given an excuse for Iranians, even for those, I mean, internal, domestically, who were against Iranian militias to support it. You know, supporting militias in Iran, in domestic politics, it was a kind of divisive issue before this. There were some people who would say, why Iran is going to Syria, why we are fighting in Syria, why we are fighting in Lebanon. But right now it's become a kind of national issue. So, okay, you don't fight, this is the result. You don't have, you know, people or militias in Iraq, near Saudi Arabia, in Yemen. They were going to, you know, to come here and you don't have anything. So it's become a nationalized, you know, issue. So both, I think it's been much of a help to Iranian, you know, policy of supporting militias than a harm or damage.
Really briefly, there was a recent news that actually Iran has made an announcement to be stepping up its support actually for Hamas from like $6 million to $30 million a month or something. So going into that, it is not a huge cost, but also the maintenance of support for some of these groups, even when faced with sanctions, which has been the case from 2010.
Just an analogy to see how cheap is that. And by giving this, I don't mean that, I mean, it's a good thing, but when we talk strategy, Saudi F-15 costs million if or 100,000 for one operation to go and bomb a few people with AK-47 barefoot, no logistic. The cost of this war against these people are much more erosive and expensive than the gain that maybe they gain it in future. So yeah, imagine that scenario that a hornet or something wants to kill one person, that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, it's a, yes, the Iranians have been long very good at low-cost warfare, I think. Listen, we've got about 15 minutes or so for questions from the floor.
Yes, John Tidmarsh, University of Sydney. I've been traveling to Iran, I guess, for 3 to 4 months each year for many, many years now, and it's astonished me how resilient the Iranian economy is, despite the sanctions. I mean, you go to any of the cities and you see these big government works continuing on in central Tehran, Hamadan, Yazd, the whole lot of them, and the metro as well. You go to the cities as well and you see big private constructions going on, especially, say, North Tehran, where all the lovely old buildings are being torn down for high-rise, and, of course, Valley Astra traffic is now absolutely impossible. Now, I know there are problems, and maybe this is confined to the upper classes, so to speak, or the wealthy people, and there's this very strong nexus between the Revolutionary Guard and the government, but and you see the massive plunge in the riyal, which for years was 33,000 the dollar, and now is 140,000, or it was a few months ago when I was there. But when I speak to people, they're not happy, but they don't say the economy is dire. But I'd love to ask our Iranian colleagues, who obviously have relatives back there, what is their opinion? What on the street, or your relatives, what are they saying? As I say, people aren't happy when I talk to them, but they're not saying this is a disaster. I think they've really fenced off their economy quite well. But what do your family members say over there?
Look, sanctions really hit hard on Iranian economy. There is no doubt about it. And it's damaged everyday people almost. Okay, you know, our exchange rate has dropped 300 or 400% within a year. And we had, those riots of 2018 and, late 2017 and early 2018. But that's, what people think that this is the end of it. What else are they going to do? So that's what happened within last like 2 years. Nothing else. The more they have. But again, there is a problem of, people are not happy. People are not happy about the situation. People are really under, pressure. There are many, sick people in the hospitals. They can't find drugs. They can't find medicines. And, you have inflation of 30%, 40%. What's the result meant to be? The result meant to be regime change or uprising, riots, nothing. But there is no option. There is no option remain for Iranian people now. So before that, reformists would say, we have a solution. We go for normalization. But right now, what's the solution? There is nobody. Nobody is offering a negotiation, a meaningful negotiation, and then those who have negotiated are betrayed. So it's a kind of very. I was in Iran like 4-5 months ago. You see frustration. You see people under pressure. They are not happy, but there is no way to. There is no feasible, reasonable, way of expressing it. Or there is no option remained for them. And this is very, it's very, very sad moment. And of course, the hardliners are using this, the advantage. They have much more strength than their domestic, political, power. Their, power of economy, they are advancing in more, other areas which they have been probably leaving before. Yeah, so it's a very, very sad situation. And of course, before that, during Obama, when there were sanctions, people would protest. Okay, there is sanction and they are, offering negotiation. Why you don't negotiate? But right now, there is nothing remain for people. Say, okay, we have negotiated and the result is Trump. And, so it's, I can say really, the most important damage of this, sanction and this maximum pressure, policy was Iranian people and pro-democracy forces in Iran. It really has suffocated them. Right now, you can talk about, let's go normalize the relations with this. People say, okay, shut up. We did this. This is the result. With 12 years with negotiations, this is the result. It's really hard. And I'm sure now they're, they're preparing for presidential election. Khamenei has very openly talked about prepare the grounds for a revolutionary young president, clearly. And they have talked about a president with a military and army background. So everything ready to again re-seize the power.
Yeah, I think what, just adding to what my friend said, when sanctions are imposed on a country, and example of other countries show that very clearly, the first thing that it damages is the civil society. It destroys the middle class and the civil society, and it did very well in Iran. And it affects, of course, people's lives in every aspect. We Iranians generally are good with keeping face. So as a tourist, if you go there, everybody tries to put a good face. So it's sort of something cultural. But it is very hard to live on those conditions. But as mentioned, it's a stalemate. Like, what do? You can't travel. You can't migrate. You are the bad guy everywhere. Your money doesn't work. And all those sort of things. So it's not a good thing these days to be, from international perspective, to be an Iranian. It's like nobody wants you and nobody is friends with you. It, for the people over there, that's the feeling. People are pissed off, like very upset. But what they can do, as mentioned, nothing almost.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeremy from Macquarie University. Thanks very much for your presentation. Turning more to the more military and security side of it, just wondering how you all think, how successful has Iran been with Hezbollah and its militias that it's backed in really embedding Iranian power within Syria, and particularly in sort of southern Syria and towards Israel and the Golan Heights. Thank you.
I basically think that the results on the ground from the news, so we don't have any access to reports, backdoor or anything like that, but from the results on the news, I think Iranian-supported troops managed to get significant successes over in Syria. So if you look at, like, before Iran engagement time, like in 2013 or times like that, the mostly Saudi, Turkish supported militia groups, like mixture of Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, and ISIL, they were at the gates of Damascus, okay? But by introduction of Iranian supported group, and you need to be careful that it's not Iranian troops, it's those groups that are organized by Iran or supported by Iran. So they managed to regain lots of territories. And yes, there are still parts in Syria that are not in the hands of government and that sort of groups who are support the government. But I think the most of the war is already won. So it's these bits and pieces may not be important. You need to remember the important parts of Syria from a strategic point of view, as far as I understand, are the west of Syria through the Lebanon borders. Like if a paramilitary group supported by any other country has a territory which doesn't have much of significance, they wouldn't be so much concerned now for that. So my answer is they have achieved something, yeah.
I'd probably just add, you know, it's been fascinating to see Iran in Syria has done essentially what the US in Iraq has done, or the US in Afghanistan, the advise and assist, less of the accompany. So it keeps the casualties down, and they've tended to be, with very few exceptions, IRGC. They haven't been the Artesh or the army. That means it also reaches to those parts of the Iranian society that are more ideologically committed to the government, so the political cost is less. And by and large, for the larger numbers, the Pakistani, Afghan and Iraqi militia groups, they tended to be used in high-risk, high-casualty areas. Hezbollah tended to be used as the militia groups against the hardest targets. So Iranian casualties have been quite low. But where they have deployed elements that breach what Israel believes to be an acceptable level of expertise held in Syria, then they're subject to air attacks by the Israelis. So the Iranians have been quite careful about how they've deployed in Syria and who they've deployed in Syria. And they've done something not dissimilar in Yemen, and it's essentially how most of the warfare is going on in the region. The Emiratis do exactly the same thing with the southern separatist groups as well, advise and assist, rarely accompany.
Thank you. I've got a simple question, which is really what next? Because it seems that you've described a situation which is essentially a stalemate, satisfactory to neither party, in that Iran is suffering from the effects of the reimposed sanctions, but is able to maintain the behaviour which America used as the excuse for reimposing the sanctions. And I wonder whether you think either party is likely to take a step which to radically change the situation. And possible steps, I suppose, would be for Iran to significantly step up its nuclear program. And from the United States side, I really don't know what they could do, but they certainly have a lot of military force in the region. So it's what next? Thank you.
Thanks. That's an excellent question and probably a very good question to finish on, because that will be our time up. But I'd probably start with Gaurana from a US perspective. What is a viable or probable US policy end state?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's like that book, Nobody Wants War, right? But basically perception and misperception matter, and the US now obviously sending these additional troops and kind of engaging in these missions, which are meant to deter Iranian aggressive or assertive behavior, are actually putting it in the risk that there might be some sort of escalation, or there is a chance for escalation if there is any sort of mishap. And this is something that I think is more worrying than just, you know, Iran announcing that it's going to enrich uranium now at 4.6 level instead of 3.6 or something. I mean, the breakout capacity is still, and I'm not a nuclear physicist, but I trust scientists there, that it is still far off from that threshold. So I think the greater worry is for us now that, you know, there are these analogies that are being drawn. Is this the kind of 1964 kind of where we might see a Gulf of Tonkin kind of redux? Or is this the sort of late 2002-2003 period where some sort of intelligence that's very shaky might actually bring about some sort of, you know, action that's based on overreaction and kind of emotional response that we know President Trump has not been really, you know, kind of vaccinated against? And this is something that worries many. And this is a sort of fear where, you know, we go from the kind of maximum pressure where it is mainly about the economic strangulation to something that's much more perilous. And knowing that we are a year just before the presidential elections, we have to keep that in mind as well, because it is not unknown that presidents actually launch a military action as a way to divert from or deflect from what's happening maybe domestically. And again, as an academic who has studied a bit of that as well, the kind of diversionary theory of war is something that's worrying as well. And that, you know, is anyone's guess, that sort of spiral. Once you escalate, how do you get out? Because it's not Iraq, right? And that's what a lot of people are saying. This is not the kind of, this wouldn't be a replay of Iraq 2003. It would be way more dire and way more costly for both sides, even if the US has the capabilities maybe to prevail, but after how long and, you know, at what cost? Don't want to think about that even.
Okay, knowing we've only got about a minute or so, and you outlined about the kind of hopelessness for the situation for the average Iranian in the current circumstances, yeah, economically and politically. Do you see any next step that Iran is likely to do, or is it, as you said before, going to be more of the same?
Mm. You know, it will depend mainly on what the U.S. is building. So is it going to probably behind the scene give some, relief to Iranian economy, oil export or something, or is it going to continue? I think Iranians are really investing or banking on U.S. unwillingness and inability to wage an all-out war in the Middle East, if it acts rationally, which again, this is if is important, because apparently now within the last 2 years, we are seeing that really many of international important, you know, say trends are neglected and diverted to something which is important, which is not important. We are here now with low institutes, Asia power, lots of issues going on in South China Sea. Here we had this, you know, lots of issues here, probably much more important. You're going even to more important trends in technology. What happens in AI if, you know, we're just going to war in the Middle East, we are just wasting our, you know, and these are game changing. So if there are some reason in Washington, Iranians are thinking that They aren't going to involve in any all-out war. So what they do is that, and we are not allowing the U.S. to go to a selected, you know, target war or something. So they are trying to give the message, this is either or, zero or 100. Or you're going to war, an all-out war or no. So they, if the, I mean, the sanctions continue, I think that Iranians will continue to escalate, either by nuclear, I mean, the again, increasing higher level of uranium enrichment, probably doing other, I mean, measures, targeting, I guess, Saudi Arabian oil facilities much more, in a much bigger scale by Houthis, probably targeting, I don't know, it might be even some military. I don't think they will, I mean, risk American lives, probably in Iraq, some other, you know, facilities. So I think they will escalate.
Just to, I think I'll have a little bit of angle with what mentioned. First of all, to answer your question, I think the case of Iranian nuclear thing, whatever is that, has been so much exaggerated. Like, when we listen the news on the radio or television here or in America, the Gulf, Iran, nuclear, I mean, the person who is sitting here may not have so much of understanding that how entangled countries and societies are together in Middle East. You cannot use as an state, whatever the state would be, even it's Israel or Iran or any place, to use the nuclear weapon without having its own people or parts of its territories affected. So it's, I think, basically the nuclear thing is an exaggerated thing. From both sides, they may talk about this, but at the moment of using, nobody would use that. Once that, from the other perspective, and I end up with that, is that historically, at least since the last 200 years, Iran was the country in the region that have been receiver of the aggressions, okay? So through that experience of receiving aggressions, there is a heritage of knowing how to diplomatically deal with bigger powers, okay? And I think, yes, there may be some little bits and pieces here and there. They may be crazy guys waking up in the morning doing something. Rogue elements might be something that have happened. But moving aside all those things, I think Iran, as Mahmoud said, would continue sort of managing the situation till the next elections and see what will happen after that.
Thank you. And listen, thank you, everybody, for coming up. I know we've gone a couple of minutes over time, but first of all, I'd just like to ask everybody to show their appreciation for our three panelists today.